A warm welcome to this podcast episode on redefining leadership, finding balance at the top. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy of Leadership, known by its German acronym as the IAF. Based in the town of Gummersbach near Cologne, the Academy develops leaders working for partner organizations of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom from all over the world, bringing together experts, opinion leaders, committed young liberals, and aspiring leaders to share specific experiences and knowledge to develop themselves and their organizations, and to explore liberal solutions and responses to public policy challenges. My name is Clinton Depriere, and in today's episode, we're exploring the theme of balance in leadership, recognizing burnout, and exploring ways of countering it that help sustain us in a world of impossible demands on our attention and what feels like ever-increasing pressure and to-do lists. I'm also joined by my dear colleague and friend, Marike Groenewald, as co-host in today's conversation. Hello, Marike.
Hello, Clinton. Hello, Jennifer. And it is a real pleasure to be here again and also to introduce our dear friend and colleague in the Liberal family, Jennifer Mix, who joins us as our guest today in this conversation. I would like to just very briefly spend a minute or so introducing Jennifer. I'm going to start by saying, Jennifer, you're a mom of two. And I was thinking about when we met, and I think it was when we both went on the Digital Changemakers delegation to Hong Kong with the Friedrich Naumann Foundation. You've had some very interesting and I think impactful and impressive pit stops chapters in your career, including working as the head of operations for Sweep South, including being the human resources director for, and this is very interesting, the digital innovation unit at the German Armed Forces, and recently being the chief of staff at Monarch. And for those of our listeners who don't know, Monarch is a German-British private intelligence firm. So I think somebody with a wide range of experience and someone who's really done the time in experiencing life in different types of organizations and bringing with you such a wealth of experience. Thank you for being willing to join us in this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer, I'm wondering whether we can kick off this conversation straight into your story. I've spoken a bit now about the leadership roles you've held. I think the challenge for me was drawing out the highlights of what has been a very dense career. You've also served, or you were selected as Germany's 40 under 40. And I'm wondering whether you could just tell us a bit about your story, how it unfolded and where you are now.
Yeah, sure. I had a very clear vision of myself when I was a teenager. I knew I wanted to become a diplomat. So I did everything to actually achieve that goal. So I studied politics, law and economics in Germany and went on exchange to Hong Kong. I then studied international affairs in Geneva, Switzerland, and went to the UK for some courses. And I was always very clear on wanting to work for the foreign service. And then I did an internship at the German embassy in Buenos Aires. And I did enjoy it. I did have a great job. I did a great boss. But I also realized that the job is not fitting at all. And I just don't belong there, and I would not be happy. At least not happy in starting down at the ladder and working myself up, because I would lose myself on the way. Because I would literally just depend on whichever task and whichever goal I was given by someone else. And there was, at least for me, not enough level of independence. And so I made a pivot in my life and decided that after my master's, I would then start work in the startup scene and work my way up. And eventually, when I'm up high enough, I always had the intention to then make the switch and go back to public policy or politics. But on the way, I wanted to have more impact, or at least in the way I defined impact back then. And that was me being 20. So a whole different perspective on life. And that's what I did. I started in the startup scene. First, I wrote my master thesis on female founders in the German startup scene. It's very difficult to find enough women to interview, to have somewhat representative study. And now it has changed quite a lot. And then I started as an unpaid intern, paid intern. And then eventually my last startup job was for Sweep South, as you mentioned, in South Africa, as the head of operations. And I was supposed to do that for 5 years. But after a year, I got the job offer that I was always waiting for, kind of. So I was offered to switch into more of a public policy job. So I was offered to then work for the German Armed Forces, but in their innovation unit, which means I could use my startup knowledge, but be more in the public policy sphere. So I jumped at that. And yeah, and I guess that's how I would generally describe my life. I jumped at opportunities. And I said yes to a lot of things instead of no.
If you look, I mean, a part of me feels like it's almost you're too young to say, I look back at my career. But let's say if you look back now to this kind of recent chapter, as you said, going from what was this almost childhood dream to making a switch to being in the fast-paced startup world, then taking that experience into the innovation unit, government, public policy world, and then most recently serving as chief of staff. Was there a moment, and if there was, when was that moment where you felt, I need to make a shift? Because of course now there's another path unfolding, which we haven't spoken about.
Yeah.
And I also don't want to imply that there was this big moment. But what were the signs?
Okay. Yeah, I just didn't want to say everything within the first. I didn't want to give away everything. Also because I think the story that I just told you, it just comes so natural to me because this is the story that I told myself for so long and I told the world for so long. And it's a true story. But still, it's a masterpiece of storytelling to myself and to others. The same story, I could have also like used complete different words. And I guess that's what our podcast today is about, the different perspective, the dark side, one could also say, behind it, and the shadow. So yeah, that was definitely the part that I mentioned. But also there was a big moment, and that was just at the end, when I was moving away from South Africa, where I was actually very happy, and I didn't meet you back then. We had an introduction, but we didn't manage because we were both too busy.
Yeah.
So we met in Hong Kong instead afterwards. So yeah, when I left South Africa, where I was really happy, and I left for as I mentioned before, the thing that I always planned in life, I wanted to actually like take this opportunity. I wanted to say yes to leave the startup sector and to work in public policy, but that came at a very high price. I had to move back to Berlin. I had to leave the ocean, the nature. I was living in a small hippie village right by Cape Town. And instead, I was living, I sublet my apartment. So I had to even live with my best friend, really in the center of town. And it was busy and it was loud. There was no nature. And in my job that I had a great boss. But still, I was kind of knocking on a concrete ceiling, not a glass ceiling necessarily that had a lot to do with me being a woman, but there was a ceiling and there was something I could not crack. It has something to do with the defense sector and the public policy circle, definitely. And I think I could have cracked it. But I started to see the price that I had to pay, that I was already paying. I was paying for being in the hamster wheel. And so when they actually offered me a new contract, I didn't renew it. And instead, I wanted to take a sabbatical and travel the world, and I planned things like actually being a horse riding instructor in Iceland, things like that, for a few weeks, and then switch to something else and then decide where I want to live in the world and what I want to do. But I was clear that I wanted to do something different, and I did something different eventually, because COVID hit and changed my plans, just like all the other plans people had all over the world. And instead, I got pregnant with twins. And that was the biggest challenge I could have ever imagined. And that changed a lot, because I was, yeah, having kids, it changed everything. I was wondering, would I want my kids to do the same mistakes that I was doing, or to pay the same price? Not same mistakes, but would I want them to pay the same price? Would I want them to follow my example? And yeah, that made me question a lot. Nonetheless, I 6 months after I gave birth, I did say yes to another great challenge. And I did start working in the as chief of staff for the private intelligence company, Monarch, that I'm still a shareholder at and that I feel very closely connected to, but I left them this summer.
And can you tell us a little bit about why you left? You've spoken about this price that you paid. What is that price?
Burnout. The price was burnout. And it's not that I can pinpoint to one specific thing, because there were a lot of systemic problems along the way in companies that I was working at, and slowly I actually like burned myself out over decades. And to be honest, the last company I was working at, they made me pay the least price. So from a systemic and organizational on a systemic and organizational level, they did a lot of things right. And but it was just not enough, because I had, on the other hand, another challenge. I was mother of two, and it was a lockdown, and childcare was very difficult to get, and still is, to be honest, in Germany. Good childcare, oh my God, impossible to get good childcare that is affordable. So yeah, I was actually like stumbling into a burnout, and I've been dealing with that since. It's very difficult to actually like track when it started. I think it definitely started years before, slowly. But I pushed it down all the time, thinking everyone around me is also giving 100% always. So I just have to continue. I'm actually very good at pushing myself beyond a lot of boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, you know, when you speak about, I mean, you just mentioned a few minutes ago the stories that we tell ourselves. And this story that you just mentioned about, you know, your perspective of what other people are doing and therefore what I should be doing, together with, I think, the story that many people tell themselves about burnout, that it is an event. It is this moment in time where you're like, oof, now I'm really tired. But actually, when you start digging deeper, as you just said, burnout is more a process that then leads to a gradual realization that could be entirely disconnected to the moment that you currently find yourself in. But so much is built up to a point where it becomes untenable. Can you maybe share a little bit about what that felt like to you? What did burnout feel like to you? And what are those signs that you recognized in yourself? Because I think it's an oversimplification to say, oh, you're tired, because we know it's not that. There's a deeper sense of concern.
Hmm. So first of all, over the last few years, I've spent quite some time working on the burnout, and I met a lot of different people along the path, and none of them has one list of symptoms that is similar to the other. So everyone actually experienced it differently. There are indeed people that I met that it came out of a sudden, and it came very fast. But the majority of people actually like had it like gradually over time, and not taking it serious in the first few moments, and then it like adds up until it becomes this mountain of things that actually don't work properly anymore. And I mean, you can look at burnout on different levels. It has an emotional, content. It's emotional exhaustion, so you feel drained, overwhelmed, and sometimes even unable to cope. You can push yourself to still cope, but it's pushing and it takes energy that you didn't have to use in the past. It's a reduced performance factor. If you want to be more in a, use more business terms, it's a decline in productivity, creativity, which is depending on where you work in. That's the problem. What comes with that is you lose confidence in your abilities. Mm-hmm. And that brings you then on a more emotional level as well. So if you start losing confidence, it also drains you on, it makes you more irritable. It makes you more frustrated over small issues, things that you would have not noticed in the past. And you have also a lot of physical symptoms. You have a persistent fatigue that doesn't improve with rest. Sometimes people have sleep disturbances. They have frequent headaches and a weakened immune system. So in my case, I actually noticed, and this is where I'm still not clear, did I first have a burnout and because of that I got so sick? Or because of the sickness that I had, it was kind of the last drop that then made me burn out? I don't really know, but last year I had 3 surgeries because I just was constantly sick, and I was so sick that I had to have surgeries because it was not going away in any other way. So who knows what started what, but for me, these were kind of the symptoms levels that I experienced and that I also noticed in other people. And I have used the last year to actually do a yoga teacher training and a meditation teacher training. And let me just tell you, the people that you meet at these type of trainings, it's interesting because a lot of the yoga teachers and meditation teachers out there are not the best role models themselves in mindfulness and restfulness, but they are people who have noticed themselves very often that something is off within them, and this is their way of tackling it. So it's kind of, in a way, they are one step ahead and they are working on how to actually fight it. And on the other hand, a lot of them are not the Zen Buddha masters that they are implying to be in their teachings. So I'm talking about myself here. So I definitely, when I teach a class, I am definitely not as Zen inside as people would think I am. I am definitely on my way, but this is some of the ways that I'm dealing with, and I'm trying to actually tackle it, is to add more of these things to my life.
Mm-hmm. So just to kind of fill in the story. So you were in that, in the various roles, experienced this awakening or awareness, at least, of something is not right, decided not to continue, decided to make a change, had twins, dealing with sickness. And now we're at this point where it feels like you're on the opposite side of the spectrum, delving into yoga, mindfulness, well-being, which, as I say out loud, sounds like the opposite, but is actually quite the remedy to what you experienced. Can you tell us a little bit about that change? How did you get into that? How did you commit to that? And maybe also, what was the response around you and those closest to you when you made this sudden change?
So the sudden change came when I got sick at work. So I didn't get sick while I was at work, but while I was still in fulfilling my active role as chief of staff, I got so sick that I had to take a few months of leave, and I had as I said some surgeries then, and while in the beginning I did not take it serious on a holistic scale, I did think, well, I'm just sick, so I'm taking care of this physical illness, and then everything else is gonna is going to fall into place. And that actually didn't happen. And so for me, the first step was to acknowledge the issue. So to recognize that there is a burnout that I had to address. And if I would not address that, I would never be able to get back and be the old performing person. It was to seek support. And that is, I guess, something that you were just asking me. So how did the people around me, how was their reaction? Seeking support means that you're talking to people and you're talking to mental health professionals, but also you need to start to set boundaries. And so when you speak out, this is not only about this is how I feel, but then there's some consequences that, because everyone is then asking, so what can we do? What do we have to do? So I was prioritizing rest. I had to delegate tasks. I had to create a clear, and now this word, oh, the work-life balance. I had to like really work that out. And then I had to reassess priorities. I had to align my work with personal values, and I was focusing on sustainable goals that I could achieve in a time, given that I was actually like physically really weak. And I never was physically weak in my life. I always pushed myself over physical boundaries. So that was something entirely new to me. So I had to do the things that I was doing in the first half year of having the children. So I had children that were born 2 months too early. So I was told, in order to get the kids properly into life and to not overstimulate them, you can only do one thing per day with them. So you can, if you have a doctor's appointment, that's the one thing you do during a day. Nothing else that's happening during a day is too exciting. And I was actually remembering that. So this is what I did to actually like keep my children from being overloaded. So maybe that is something I should start with, only do one thing a day, which was very difficult to me because I was doing, at that point, I was like doing 25, 30 things a day, like started with a run in the morning or a yoga session and then going into one call, doing the other. So I stopped. I just did one thing a day. And since I was having children, that thing a day was very often related to my kids. So that was actually quite a challenge. And yeah, that leads me, I guess, to the concluding sentence. The most challenging thing about that was not my environment, but it was myself. The belief system I had in place and I still have in place, because a belief system is something that you build up from childhood and that follows you throughout your life. So that is something that was really challenging me.
Oh, I have so many questions that I want to follow up on, Jennifer, because what you're saying is so dense. I found the list of symptoms that you mentioned earlier, immune system, sleep, emotional well-being, so helpful. And I can imagine that many of the people listening to this conversation might find themselves in a position where they go, oh, wow, that's me. And it made me think about the state of the world, and especially the state of the world for people who are working in politics or governance or in the field of human rights or democracy. On the one hand, experiencing trauma almost on a daily level in the world, and on the and perhaps not just trauma, but being re-traumatized by the world. And on the other hand, most of these organizations being very attached to delivering impact, often under constraints. So facing and paying the price of a fast-paced, constrained, complex environment. I know that the IAF's audience, because it's an academy for leadership, the audience itself is a high-performing audience. And it feels to me like the response in the world to this state is to put a very superficial sticker or a plaster on the problem. You know, we speak about things like self-care when we see content creators online, or you think that downloading a mindfulness app will solve the problem, or if you do a quick breathing exercise in the morning. And what you're actually most probably doing is you're just adding one more thing to do. When you've just spoken, you spoke about how difficult it was to change yourself. Earlier, you spoke about your narrative about yourself, a story that you were telling, the story of saying yes to things. And I'm wondering, what did it take and how and what experience might you share to people listening to get to a systemic change for yourself? How do you rewrite the story about your relationship and really take care below the surface?
What you just mentioned, the mindfulness apps and things that might scratch on the surface. So if you use these type of tools sustainably, they are not scratching the surface. They are a great starting point. Yes, the point is to appreciate every little step that you could take, and also do not approach it the same way you would approach a work project, because this is how you got there. So it is okay to actually like use another pace and to use another perspective and for it to take slow. A professor I'm actually working with in psychology right now, he says that you can expect, not in all cases, but in many cases, that it takes just as long to get out of burnout as it took you to get in there. I mean, it depends where it really started. It's not the first moment that you actually like took a wrong turn, but when it really started. So, and I guess, again, comparing it to being a mother, you say it takes just as long to recover from a pregnancy as it took to be pregnant. So take a step back and have smaller steps. And we can talk about the steps that I think make sense and that could be good to take. But there's one other thing that you mentioned that I think is crucial, and it's the leadership and the leaders that are in IAF but also anywhere else in the world and doing too much in too little time. So I was influenced my whole life by leaders that I admired. I was surrounded by people I respected. But now looking back, I don't think that a lot of them respected themselves. A lot of them didn't know how to respect themselves. And this is kind of the role models that I was surrounded then. So this is how I thought. And by the way, all of them were male. Not sure if that's a coincidence or not, but men very often have even another stereotype pushed on them to be strong and to push harder and to not show any weaknesses, however you would define a weakness. But still all of them were male. And from the professor and mentor I had in university, to the startup bosses that I have, to the politicians that I was working with, not only in the Liberal Party, but in other parties as well. It's interesting when I look at them and how exhausting a life a lot of them lead. I was lacking role models. And the stories that I was reading about people who took a step back, they were inspirational. Like back then when I was listening to a podcast by Arianna Huffington, who was heading the Huffington Post, and now I don't know what she's doing. She's doing another great company. But she was talking about morning meditations and how they actually helped her to focus, to keep calm on the rest of the day that was coming. These are simple, small steps that can help you. And these are like small role model moments where you can see someone who's really thriving in the business world, but who brings in a more balancing factor on the other side. Mm. And my first tip is to just take it slow and slower as you are used to in the business world, because this is how you got there first. Yeah. That answered your question a little bit.
Yeah, it certainly led us, I think, into a new direction. And I'm so happy that you raised this almost toxic leadership trait of what we see in leadership role models. Certainly, that's been my experience too in the organizations that I've engaged with, where it's almost like the falling apart of your life is glorified.
Yeah.
If your life is falling apart, if you lose your relationships, if you become an alcoholic, if you become deeply sick, if you work through the night and you don't sleep anymore, then you're doing your job properly. And especially in politics, where it's not only in politics, but I mean, this is a political podcast. And so, you know, where it feels like the stakes are so high,
yeah,
the narrative is the future of our country, the future of our organization is at stake. So you should be giving it all. That the beginning for leaders now to realize that that is the road to burnout and losing yourself is almost also, it requires a kind of loosening yourself of who you saw as role models. And I think that can be quite disorientating and unsettling.
Can I jump in there for just one quick sentence?
Yeah.
It's about the term burnout. It's very funny, just as you mentioned, burnout as a term is somewhat even worn as a badge of honor in a lot of circles. Whereas wording matters a lot there, because I use the expression burnout with the professor that I just mentioned with that I'm working with. And he was laughing at me so hard. And he was like, Jennifer, you know, in our environment, the psychological, scientific environment, the word burnout doesn't exist. It's a synonym for depression. And depression is not accepted in society. It isn't in a business sphere, at least.
Yeah.
Burnout. Yeah, that's something people can use. Yes, you can take a few weeks to cure your burnout and then get back and work 100% again. And
yeah.
You are off for depression. Oh, no, you cannot be promoted anymore because you have a problem. So, yeah, I am here admitting that I'm working on a depression, but I'm working on a depression that other people would define as burnout. And that has actually very important to state, because to me that was kind of an eye-opening moment. So, oh, depression. Oh, there's this dark cloud that is following people around. But that's not what I'm having. This is not me. You know, yeah, there are different forms of depression. Yes, you are not the dark cloud sitting at home, not doing anything type of depression. But it exists as well. And also this could be defined as burnout. It's, again, a very highly individual thing, but in apparently in the psychological environment, the term is depression, not burnout.
I want to ask you one more question, and I'm interested in further in our conversation to go into kind of what can people do, but perhaps before we get there, you know, I think the expectation when you acknowledge to yourself that I'm experiencing burnout or depression is to, as you say, go away and take a few weeks and then come back and work even harder. Earlier, you said something like returning to the old performing person.
Yeah.
And I mean, what are you supposed to return to? Because sure, there is an active recovery period, as you said, you know, 9 months after a baby is born, you're still busy recovering in your body. But surely the intention is not to take all these active steps so that you can just become the high performer again, so that you can just burn out again in 2 years from now. So what is this new you?
So again, there are two different types of two different things that you could do. You could work on primarily actually getting out of the phase that you are in, the dark cloud or whatever, however it manifests with you, and then you can return to your work environment, but use the tools that you have learned along the way to make you cope better with that, and to help you cope and to help you actually reflect better on it and to have more of a self-awareness around that. So I think it's 100% possible to return to the same environment, as long as it's not a toxic environment that 100% caused you to get there. But very often there are underlying belief systems, as I mentioned before, that actually get you to the point where you are. And if you are working on those, very often you are not as affected by the environment as you used to before, but you can return to the same environment or another, and you can cope with it using the tools that you learned, or you actually return to the environment and you start changing it. So you make the environment itself more sustainable. And it depends on where you are. That's sometimes you are greeted with open arms. As I said, the last company that I was working at, they were doing a great job actually implementing a lot of the things. But these were people with military background, intelligence background, people who were used to very high stress, but who also knew that they could only sustain this high level of stress if they had other things in place that would help them balance it out. So it is possible to actually work with that and balance it out, either by yourself at home or at work and changing the environment. So there are two different levels and two different paths you could take. Obviously, the best one would be to take both paths the same way. So to learn how to cope with it yourself and change your environment. But let's be realistic. Our world is, as you said, challenging these days. And not everyone is greeting change in that direction with open arms. So maybe just start with yourself first, and then let's see.
I wanna pull on that thread a little bit. As he was speaking now about a world that glorifies burnout and falling apart. on a lighter note, it reminded me of that scene in The Devil Wears Prada where Meryl Streep's character says to Andrea in the film, she's like,
yeah,
"That'd be ridiculous, Andrea. Everybody wants this. Everybody wants to be like us."
Yeah.
And she has this moment where she's like, "What if I don't want to have this life?" So if we're, maybe people who are listening to this are finding themselves in industries much like you have that are dominated by valuing toughness, high performance, which seemingly are at odds with a culture of well-being. I don't think it is. But perhaps in those industries, the likelihood of people thinking about mindfulness, yoga, or the broader term of well-being, they view it with skepticism, with suspicion. How would you explain, or how would you describe the value of deep well-being, real well-being, to those people in those industries who find themselves feeling a little bit skeptical about it? And might I just say that my own listening to the word of well-being is that sometimes it is overused, and sometimes I think there's a negative connotation that sometimes comes with the word well-being, because it's perhaps sometimes used as a shield or as an excuse not to perform as you want to. So there's a difficult balance between the two. On the one hand, taking it seriously because it is a serious issue, and on the other hand, not overusing it and not making light of something that really deserves our attention. So how would you speak to people who view it with skepticism?
Oh, I love that question. First of all, just a little reminder that mindfulness and yoga is not the answer to everything. So it's only part of the solution. But let's focus on these two, because they are great. Actually, they are the two steps that I took most serious and most professionally, and have my latest education in. So in order to actually address people who are more performance based, to put it this way, I would answer on eye level. Yoga and mindfulness is not about softening toughness. It's about sharpening the edge leaders need to thrive in today's demanding environments. And you can actually take this on different levels. So first of all, you can emphasize the practical benefits over the philosophy. So me, myself, as I mentioned before, I'm not a Buddhist goddess. I'm literally just taking the benefits of...
You are not? What is... No, why did we get you on?
I mean, you are a goddess, but...
No, love my coffee. And I love getting passionate about things. After all, I'm half Romanian. And no, I'm definitely not the Zen perfect example, but that's exactly what this is about. I mean, it's a these are very old techniques that are supported by modern neuroscience and psychology. There is science behind that. So first of all, let's emphasize the practical benefits over the philosophy. They are not just about relaxation. They are tools to enhance focus, resilience, and decision-making. Yes, they are rooted in centuries of practice, but as I said, they are also supported by modern science. So mindfulness improves mental clarity, reduces reactivity, enhances emotional intelligence. I mean, this is essential for leaders who need to make quick, complex decisions. Yoga supports physical and mental stamina by reducing tension, improving posture, increasing energy levels. I mean, that's also critical for leaders. So think of mindfulness as a mental workout and yoga as a physical recovery. They're like training your mind and body for peak leadership performance. Of course, you could also go running, but yoga, as I said, there's science and evidence behind it that it's particularly helpful, especially if you are going through a burnout and you have physical illnesses and you have fatigue. Well, you cannot go running for an hour like you used to go, or 2 hours, or whatever you did, you high performer, you. You try to find other things that you can maintain even with a lower energy level that has high impact. So use evidence and data to actually like to tell these people who have some hesitations. Mindfulness reduces stress and anxiety by lowering the cortisol level. It improves concentration and creativity by strengthening the prefrontal cortex. I'm giving you a lot of science here, but yeah.
And that's the key thinking part of the brain. The decision-making part, yeah.
And it enhances the interpersonal relationships by improving your empathy and listening skills. So that's mindfulness. You can like kind of like take that off the list. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yoga, on the other hand, reduces physical pain and tension, particularly in the back and the neck and the shoulders, common in desk jobs. So that helps you like cope with that as well. It increases heart rate variability. It's a marker of resilience and stress recovery. And it promotes better sleep, which directly impacts cognitive and emotional functioning. Sleep is like one of the most important thing actually to make you recover. So it's not about spirituality. It's about strategy. It's the strategy that you have for your own body and mind to recover. Also, there's a link to high performance culture. Like I mentioned before, Arianna Huffington is using that. Microsoft has programs for, or Google, companies like that. They have programs to actually like make their leaders, but also in general, their employees take some time off in their busy schedule to recover. So tools that enhance, not replace, the qualities valued in tough and high pressure industries. It's like a hack. So using mindfulness and yoga is like a hack. So elite athletes and military leaders, the intelligence people in the intelligence sector, they use mindfulness to stay sharp, focused, and composed under pressure. So it's a performance enhancer, not a sign of weakness. We, in our strategy retreats of the leadership in the intelligence company that I was working at, we started the day with a yoga session that was not led by me, by the way, but by one of our former leaders at the intelligence sector in the UK. And I was personally leading some meditation sessions. So, and yes, for some people in the leadership team that was new, but all of them were open to it because they knew about the benefits. So you can frame it as a leadership essential, and you can normalize it through familiar examples. Like I said, use some executives or companies who do it. And then what I mentioned before as well, it's always essential to start small and accessible. No, you do not have to do the 1.5 hour hot yoga session followed by a 1 hour meditation sitting on your cushion type of thing. You start with 1 minute in between meetings, just focusing on your breath. That calms you down. And by the way, when it comes to breathing, small advice, focus on your breathing out. So have a double the length of breathing out than breathing in. And that actually calms you down after like 3 to 4 long breaths. So 1 minute mindfulness practice, have a little desk yoga or stretch. It doesn't have to be like, you do not have to be a pretzel. So I guess that's what I have to say about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That it doesn't have to be time consuming. It doesn't have to be mystical or spiritual. It's not about being calm all the time. I am not calm when I am like with my kids who freak me out. But I do sense that there is calmness in myself, and I can get back to that. And by the way, my kids, when I am getting particularly nervous, they're like, "Mommy, breathe out. Come on, we breathe out together." So they are actually like using the example that I showed them, and they have it in themselves right now very often. They're like, okay, we hold our hands and then we breathe out. And I'm so proud that I actually like put this little seed in them, and it makes a difference.
Yeah. Isn't it annoying when people use your own things against you and they call you out?
Yeah.
It touches on what I wanted to, I suppose, where my mind went next. Before I'll hand over to Marika as well on this kind of broader level, because I suppose we're talking now about people who find themselves in a system that is resistant to A, recognizing burnout or depression, and B, being less open or susceptible to embracing the types of practices that we just spoke about now. And I can imagine people listening to this say, "Oh yeah, that's very nice of you. What luxury you're living to be able to have colleagues that don't burst out laughing when you mention that, you know, you're having a tough day. Just, you know, buckle up and get on with it." So I can imagine there are people who might feel like this conversation feels like a, you know, pie in the sky, pipe dream world that you're describing. And yet there are, I believe, always, there is always something that you can do as an individual, despite the circumstances that you're in. You mentioned some of the small things now, which for me has just in this conversation changed my own perspective on the small steps that are often, advised, that are often suggested in big companies, you know, say take a mindfulness minute. And I used to look at that skeptical, but I think after this conversation, perhaps the framing around it needs to change, that it's not, oh, this is the one thing that's going to solve all of that, but it is your opportunity to take control of a little piece that is one step in a direction that is going to help you to take charge, you know, of your own reaction, and to start building that, and that it is a practice rather than an event, a moment that now solves everything. Are there any other things that you can suggest to people who find themselves in those circumstances where they're really even asking the question of introducing mindfulness into the environment is out of the question? There's too much risk. It's a low trust environment. What can someone in that environment do to take control of that for themselves? Just very practical things that come to mind for you.
So very practical is that you think about what are my, as a human, basic needs that I have, and are they met? And basic needs are sleep, water, food, and so things like that. So what are, I mean, you can also ask, I guess, ChatGPT to actually answer you that question. What are the basic needs a human have? But I suggest that you sit down and do it for yourself. So if you do not have enough sleep, your stress level is extremely high. And then your body will try to artificially improve this cortisol and stress level. So it will ask you for very bad food, for a high fat, low protein
foods that actually will make you feel even worse. So people always say, listen to your body. At some point, you should not listen too much to your body, because if you do not have your general, your basic human needs met, your body is going to go into like such an emergency mode all the time, every day, that it will ask for the wrong things. So if you are dehydrated, you might misjudge it for being hungry. So you are eating more, but you are not also like, yeah. So answering that in very simple terms, try to sleep enough, prioritize that, deprioritize your evening wind down with a screen. It has a massive impact actually on your sleep. If you look at your screens like an hour before sleep, I know it's very difficult. I'm addicted to Grey's Anatomy. I admit that publicly.
Still, what are they on, like 50 seasons now?
21st season.
Oh no.
I think there's a turn I didn't expect.
Friends, by heart. I loved, and I still love sometimes winding down by looking at things that I already know. But also, I actually am now much, much better at telling myself, no, I'm going to prioritize sleep because of everything that has followed around that. And then prioritize good food. It doesn't have to be expensive. My gosh, good, healthy food does not have to be expensive. It's starting your day with some oats and it's like a nice muesli cereals. And it does not have to be the fancy one. It can be the cheap one that you actually just mix together without the sugar. And then you have some nice veggies during the day. And it does not have to be the fancy salad. It can be easy things. I always carry nuts with me to like actually like fight the first hunger, so that when I then eat, I know I eat because I'm hungry, but not because I'm hangry. And yeah, it's like following these basic needs. And then, yeah, if you cannot change your environment, this is how you can start. And then again, breathing. And taking a few minutes in the evening. It would be great if you would sit down and journal. Yeah, I did that last year when it was in the thick of the burnout. Now I'm much less strict with myself. So I do not sit down and write down, which would be the best. But the second best is you lie in your bed and you ask yourself one of the two things that to me are the most impactful. You either lie in bed when you really try to sleep and you ask yourself, what are the 14 things that I did well today? I promise you will not get to 14 because you will fall asleep, because it's very boring to think about that. But it's the best thing to have in the back of your mind when you fall asleep, something positive that you have done. And it can be small things. It does not have to be, oh, I nailed this and I was great at that. No, it can be, oh, I managed to get the bus on time. And I actually like managed to eat a healthy breakfast instead of a not so healthy breakfast. And I was not screaming at my kids at that moment when I wanted to. No, I said more calm. I was not the perfect mother, but I was a good enough person. So it's about finding the 14 things where you are like good enough to start to end the day. Or you do the thing that I do with my kids every evening. You talk about the three best things that happened during the day. And again, this doesn't have to be big things. Sometimes to me, the best thing is to have a really good barista coffee. By the way, I'm not having caffeine that much anymore. I'm having one coffee a day. And I really enjoy that moment. And I sit down and really have a good moment around that. Yeah. So these are small things to start small with. And then when you have like a little bit more strength, then you might take bigger steps. But if you do not have your basic needs fulfilled, there's no need in adding more on that on top.
I'm wondering two things. The first is, I'm wondering whether you would be willing to do a breathing exercise with us as a way to wrap up this conversation, because I can imagine that might be a really helpful way also for people listening to this conversation to just take a minute and notice their breathing. But before we get to that, Jennifer, Clinton and I are thinking a lot about the concept of hope, and hope not just as something where you look to the future and you have this almost naive, passive assessment that, oh yeah, maybe something can be different, but hope really as an active emotion that things can be different, that you want to play a part in it, that you can change, that your organization can change, that the world can change and be better. And I think it's a topic that we need in the world at the moment. And I'm just wondering, what is it that gives you hope at this time?
Yeah, I must admit there are a lot of things that don't give me hope. Looking at politics, not only in Germany, but other countries as well. But there's also a lot of things that give me hope, but it's individual people. So it's looking more at individual people and what they're doing, and not talking about famous people who are like doing role model-y things. No, I'm talking about people in my environment. So what gives me hope is very strange example maybe, but I was, my kids were invited 2 weeks ago to a home of a mother and in kindergarten, and to visit her children. So they play together, and she's from Syria and her husband as well. And they are both doctors from Syria. And oh my gosh, she was like, she was kind of like an example of why I don't like living in Germany that much, because I have experienced her hospitality and her welcoming and the amount of foods she put on the table and the thoughtfulness. And oh my gosh, that was just so great. And it gave me a lot of, like, as strange as it sounds, but this small afternoon, it gave me so much hope that there are so many great people out there who do great things just in their everyday life. And I mean, she's a medical doctor. She's doing great things at her workplace as well. But I'm talking about my small experience that I had there of just being welcoming to however loud my kids were and whatever their desires were. And that gives me hope, like individual people. Or just, yeah, there's this other thing. And again, my head is wired differently since more than a year, because I ask myself in the evening, what are the three best things that I experienced? So during the day, I actually have much more open eyes to like small moments. So there's this female construction worker that I pass every day on my bike when I get the kids from kindergarten. And she's smiling. Sometimes she's waving just at people walking by. And the other day I just stopped and told her, you know what, you make my day. Every day when I pass you, you are just nice. May I ask why? And she's like, because sometimes I get a smile back. And I was like, she's doing this hardcore construction worker job. And she takes the time to say hi and smile to people that pass. So this gives me hope that there are people like that to just do it to get nothing back or a similar nice thing back. So yeah.
I think it's so beautiful that you stopped and spoke to her, and it just reminded me again that there is an opportunity and a chance for all of us in the world to, when we notice something in somebody, to say it to them, and to keep our hearts open to that almost so basic level of human interaction that is also the most powerful human interaction. And to not let woundedness and division and self-protection close us from that. But that is also a pathway to healing. Would you be willing to guide us in a breathing exercise?
Sure. Sure. Let's do a minute of breathing together. So there are different breathing techniques, but let's start with a easy to remember one. It's called the box breathing, and box like the box that you have here. It's 4 by 4 by 4. So you breathe in 4 seconds, you hold the breath for 4 seconds, then you breathe out 4 seconds, and then you hold that for 4 seconds. And you do that a few times. I'm going to time a minute. You can close your eyes if you want. Works best if you close your eyes. And I will dictate it to you. So I'm going to breathe in 4, 3, 2,
One, you pause. Four, three, two, one. You breathe out. Four, three, two, one. And you keep that. Four, three, two, one. You breathe in. Four, three, two, one. Keep that. Four, three, two, one. Breathe out. And you hold that. And now you breathe in fully and breathe out. And if you do that for like 3 or 4 rounds, it will calm your nervous system significantly.
It is amazing, the almost a tingling feeling that you feel.
Yeah, especially the holding the breath. It's something that you're not used to, and it makes you more aware.
Yeah. And it's so simple and easy and free.
Yeah, and because it's a box and four, I think it's something that you can also remember and like take into your everyday life and not be like, oh, how was it again? Three in, five out. No, four. That's easier.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you, Jennifer. I want to appreciate your in this conversation. By way of wrapping up, Marika and I we love to end on an appreciative note. And I really want to appreciate your vulnerability today in speaking about your own journey, sharing your experience so that people can take from it. And at the same time, I also want to appreciate your practical thinking and your practical approach to it. It restores hope that we can change ourselves, and then we can change maybe some people around us, our organizations, and maybe a little part of the world that we're in. I find that comforting today. A deep sense of appreciation for you for joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jennifer.
This episode forms a part of the IAF podcast series that accompanies regular seminar programs of the International Academy for Leadership in Gummersbach, Germany, as I mentioned before. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes, share your thoughts and response, and keep an eye on the work of the IAF and its various social media channels. It certainly is a treat to keep track of that. Until we meet next time. Bye.